Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, y'all. I'm glad to see y'all and hear y'all and all everything in between. Welcome to Raven Real Steel Radio. This is your girl, Raven the Period Poet, bringing to y'all another 31 Day of Horror. So, if you are in the building, make sure you lock your doors, make your snacks and all that great stuff. Also, if you want to call in, the number is 914-205-5813. That is 914-205-5813. I ain't going to hold nothing up. I'm not going to over-talk and all that great stuff. We're just going to jump into it. All right.
This happened 24 years ago in July of 1996. I had finished my term of service for the Army. I was stationed at Fort Hood, Texas, and decided at midnight I would out-process and travel back to Wisconsin. All day I was so anxious to go that I had trouble sleeping. Finally, at 23:45, I got out of bed and went to sign out with the desk sergeant. Of course, knowing people wanted to sign out at midnight, he decided to do his rounds. You can't leave until you get your final sign-off with the sergeant and turn in your room key. So I waited and waited, and finally, at 02:45, he returned. I turned my key in, got the sign-off, and at 03:30, I was on my way. At first, I was so full of adrenaline that I felt that I could drive for days. Unfortunately, that adrenaline didn't last long, and by the time I was getting through Dallas, I was nodding off. I decided just past Denton that I would pull over at the next rest stop and take a quick nap until the sun came up. I could barely keep my eyes open when I came up to a stop. I pulled over and got out of my car to get some air and throw something away and to get a look at my surroundings. There were only about three other cars and two semi-trucks there. It was a picnic stop and not a rest stop, so no restrooms. I threw my trash away and glanced at a poster of a few missing persons, but I really didn't pay any attention to it. I went back to my car, which was a basic Geo Metro. No radio, no power windows, no power locks. I cracked the windows and turned on the boombox I had for some tunes and laid down to get some sleep. I was only asleep maybe 5 or 10 minutes when I felt my car shake just slightly. I cracked an eye open and looked and didn't see anything, so I blew it off and went back to sleep. I then heard what sounded like my door handle being pulled and scratched on the door key. I then sat up quickly, but I didn't see anyone there. I looked at all the windows and didn't see anyone, so again I shrugged it off as me being tired and laid back down and turned up the radio. Being a Texas night in July, it was hot, but I was so tired I just laid back down. A few more minutes later, I heard the door handle again and car really shook. I sat up quickly and saw a man standing at the passenger's side looking in. Even though it was hot and humid, he was wearing a red sweatshirt with the hood up and I couldn't see his face. Being young and dumb and just out of the military, I yelled at him, asking, "What the F do you want?" He just stared at me like an idiot, and I got out of the car. Mind you, I'm only 5'6", but I was livid. He just walked off towards the picnic tables like nothing happened. All the while, I'm yelling at him that if he came back, I'd take him out. I decided I would just drive on from there. I got back in and went on my way. Even though I was so upset, only about 10 miles down the road, I was super tired again. Luckily, about another 10 miles down I-35, there was another picnic stop. Not sure why North Texas doesn't have rest areas, but they don't. I pulled into the second picnic stop and backed into a spot just in case I needed to leave quickly. Not sure why, but there was only one other car there and no semi-trucks. I again locked the doors, cracked the windows, and turned on my boombox. I fell asleep right away, and about 30 minutes later, I hear a loud thud on my driver's side window. I jumped up and looked around, and no one was there. I got out of the car, which was very stupid, but I had my macho military attitude going. But no one was around. I assumed it was my nerves from the other stop. I got back into my car, locked the doors again, and closed my eyes. This time I was too amped up to fall asleep, so I laid there with my eyes closed. I felt that someone was looking at me, and I opened my eyes and saw the guy standing there again with the red sweatshirt, hood up. I couldn't see his eyes, but I could see he was smiling at me. I popped up quick and tried to quickly open the door and bump him. Being a cheap Geo, since the doors were locked, it didn't open. He walked backwards, still staring at me. By the time I got out, he was about 30 feet away, facing me. It was fairly dark, but as I looked him over, he looked really skinny, but was about 6'2", maybe 6'3", but I still felt like I could take him with my military experience. He was wearing the red hooded sweatshirt, blue jeans, and green tennis shoes. For some reason, I thought the shoes looked odd. I could see something shine every now and then as he stood there staring at me, and I honestly believe it was a machete. I quickly reached into my back seat and grabbed my baseball bat and started yelling at him to come get some. I'm not really sure why I said that. He started walking towards me, and I took a few steps towards him, not really thinking. As I got about 5 feet away from my car, and he was now about 15 feet from me, a yellow van pulled up quick and parked just off to the side of the road. I finally realized what was happening, and I saw two guys also wearing hooded sweatshirts in the van. Before they could get out, I ran back to my car. I had left the keys in the ignition. Since I had backed in, I was able to cut it hard right and peeled my car out of there. I was so lucky. Being a manual car, I didn't stall the car because the other two guys were out of the van, and the first guy was just about at my car. I jumped back on the interstate and didn't stop until I was about 20 miles into Oklahoma. I stopped for gas and to use the restroom. In the restroom, I noticed that same flyer I barely glanced at the first picnic stop. It was basically a flyer with several missing persons on it and warning people not to stop for long periods of time at the rest areas. It described a possible suspect as possibly 6 foot, wearing blue jeans, green shoes, and a red hooded sweatshirt. I completely went white. Needless to say, since it was daylight, I drove the rest of the way to Wisconsin, wide awake. Not sure why, but I never reported it to the number on the flyer or told anyone about it. But now I live in North Texas and pass those two picnic stops every day on my way to work, and I think about it quite often. This had to have happened sometime in the early 2000s. My husband was still spending most of the time on the road working for one of the major insurance companies. As a result of this, myself and our young daughter spent the majority of our days alone. A few years prior, we had purchased a new home on a somewhat isolated piece of land, and the journey between town and home could often be harrowing, especially at times of heavy rain. Most of the last 5 miles of the road that led to the house was nothing more than loose gravel and wasn't very wide, for that matter. My daughter and I found ourselves stuck on this section of road on a really bad night. I did all that I could to keep our old Subaru on the road, but the rain made visibility almost impossible. It wasn't long until I misjudged one curve and ended up in the ditch. Fortunately, my husband had the foresight to sign us up to one of those roadside assistance programs. I contacted them and was told that the weather was keeping them busy, but they would get to us as soon as possible. Not knowing how long we'd be stuck there, I made my daughter as comfortable as I could and waited. The rain stopped soon after, and I was now able to see how far away from home we were. I estimated it was about 2.5 miles to the house and considered walking, until remembering no one was at home to retrieve the car later. Help was on its way, so I could wait. Within 10 minutes of the accident, I could see the headlights of a truck coming towards us and began to get excited. However, it didn't turn out to be a tow truck. Instead, it was an older man driving a rusty pickup. When he saw the car, he slowed down and looked into it as he passed. I thought he was about to offer to pull us out, but he continued down the road. I didn't think anything of it at the time, but 5 minutes later, the rusty truck approached us coming from the other direction at a very slow speed. He stared at me once again as he passed, even making eye contact with me briefly, but didn't stop. Things were beginning to look odd, but I thought maybe he was lost and turning around to return to the highway. He wasn't obligated to help. Perhaps he thought I was parked instead of stuck. He probably wasn't from around there and was just trying to get home like I was. Things didn't start to get scary until I noticed the same truck coming toward us for a third time. It had gotten completely dark by this point, and most women I know feel much less safe once the sun goes down. This situation made things even more sketchy. He did his usual by now slow drive-by. What was different this time was that he stopped the truck after he passed and did a quick 3-point turn in the road. He was now facing us again, stopped about 10 yards away. Rather than get out and come over to offer aid, he sat in the cab and watched for a few minutes. Only now did he open the door and begin to get out of the truck. Almost as soon as his foot hit the pavement, a pair of headlights appeared from the other direction. The man stayed where he was, just watching and waiting for a minute before it was close enough to see it was a tow truck. Once he saw this, he jumped back in his cab and made a quick U-turn and sped away from us. My heart was stuck in my throat as I watched this play out, and not until I could read the name of the company on the side of the tow truck could I begin to relax. The tow truck driver didn't hesitate to pull his truck in front of us and hook up to my car. I was finally confident he was there to help, and I got out to thank him. He had us out of the ditch in a few minutes, and we were on our way. For the remainder of the journey, I kept my eyes open for the rusty truck, and even as I drove up our drive, I feared I'd see him lying in wait for me. He was not, thankfully, and I got my daughter into the house for the night. When my husband returned from his latest trip, I told him about what had happened during the last storm, but I left out the part with the strange truck. I knew it would only make him more stressed when he was away, and at that time, he had no other choice but to continue his trips. Because of this latest trouble, he went out and purchased an almost new Jeep with a 4x4 transmission for me. I was over the moon to get it, and I never got stuck again, even on the muddy parts of our property. It didn't take long for the stranger in the rusty truck to pass from my mind. However, for the next 2 weeks, I caught myself looking for it any time I was on that stretch of road. I had almost completely forgotten about that incident until just recently, when I saw a truck similar to it at the store. It, of course, was not the same one, but it caused it all to come flooding back and motivated me to write this. Fortunately, in the preceding years since then, the county has paved and widened the roads, and my wonderful husband gets to come home to us every night. About 5 years ago, I was living at a home with my parents, and my twin brothers were there too. Every morning at 7 a.m., we would both head out for a run. We had mapped out this giant loop that we would run. To make it a bit of a competition, I would run it in one direction, and my twin would run in the other direction. That way we could run and stay focused. Part of this loop was on the main street of the city my parents lived in. On this main road, there were these shady apartments kind of hidden by a bunch of trees. The direction I was running, the views of these apartments were obscured by giant hedge bushes, and I couldn't see the apartments until I was right in front of them. Out of my peripherals, I see a woman standing among the trees, staring at me. I sort of immediately get chills and don't turn to face her because I didn't want to be rude. So I run on and forget about this a few minutes later. I pass my twin about 10 minutes later. He's going in the opposite direction as I was. I get home and my twin isn't back yet, so I go about the rest of my morning routine, including taking a shower. I get out of the shower and my twin hasn't come back yet, and I'm starting to get a little bit worried. An hour after I had gotten home, he's still not back, and I call him. He tells me he's on his way back, and he has something he needs to tell me and my parents. He finally gets home and tells me that as he's running in front of these apartments, he saw a woman hanging from the trees in front of this apartment. As soon as it's obvious he sees her, a man comes sprinting from the apartments, wailing and screaming, "No, I can't believe she did this," and grabs her body and lays her on the ground and starts performing CPR. It was obvious that it was her husband. My brother calls the local police and they dispatch an ambulance and police officers. My brother has to stay for questioning as a witness to this report and the whole process there, and he's obviously troubled by it. Since he was going the opposite way that I was running, he didn't have a hedge obscuring his view and got a straight-on view of this woman hanging there. It's still hard for me to believe that the woman I saw staring at me out of my peripherals was dead the entire time. I do find it very sketchy that the husband came running out as soon as it was obvious that someone had discovered the body. That is a bit too convenient if you ask me, but I don't want to say that this man killed his wife without any evidence. My brother was never followed up by the police, leading me to believe that the death was in fact her taking her own life. I just still can't fathom that if I would have turned to face this woman, I would have discovered her about 20 minutes earlier than my twin had, and it deeply troubles me that I didn't. I live in a place called Dark Hollow, about 20 minutes outside of Pittsburgh. It's a really nice neighborhood, really leafy and green with some really nice old houses, and I won't deny that I've been immensely privileged to have grown up there. But at the same time, there was a huge downside to living there too, and that came in the form of the Ward family. The Wards were an absolute nightmare to live near to, and they made pretty much every other family's lives unbearable at some point for a variety of different reasons. Individually, they were bad enough, but collectively, they were like a horror movie level of nightmarish. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if there was some budding horror filmmaker who writes or directs the next Hereditary, and it all comes out that it was inspired by the Wards. The patriarch of the family was named Winston, or Wynn for short, but being one of Wynn's neighbors was nothing short of a serious loss. Now for reference, I had most of my encounters with Wynn when I was a teenager, and being a girl, Wynn always took a certain liking to me that he just didn't show to other people. He was always sickeningly polite with me, the kind of polite that verged on weirdly flirtatious. To other people, it probably just seemed like he was overly nice, maybe a little socially awkward. But being alone with Wynn, or in situations where there weren't close observers, that was a different situation entirely. There were a handful of occasions where I caught Wynn looking at me in a way that made my skin crawl. He had a hunger in his eyes, like this beastly, ravenous look, like he wanted to eat me alive. His eyes would glaze over and his lips would curl up ever so slightly in this horrifically perverted way that always made me feel stupidly uncomfortable. There was one time when I bumped into him in a convenience store near to downtown Pittsburgh. After he said hi and made a little small talk, he seemed to follow me around the store for a little while. He acted all innocent, making out like he was just browsing stuff in the aisles, but at some point, he got way too close to me. I think I was just too nervous to actually do anything about it. I didn't want to make a scene or cause any unnecessary conflict. After all, what would I tell people? Mr. Ward stood near me in a store. Anyways, when he was standing close to me, I heard him sniffing the air, like taking these big inhalations of breath through his nose, almost like he was trying to smell me. I couldn't walk away fast enough, and in the end, I left the store without even picking up what I went in there to buy. Like I said, he was overly nice to girls and women, but an absolute monster to any boys or men who happened to catch him in the wrong mood. He once ran out of the house with a baseball bat when my big brother used their driveway to turn around once. And the way he told it, if he hadn't driven away as fast as he could, Mr. Ward probably would have done some damage to his car. Then there was his wife, Maggie. Maggie always wore way too much makeup. I mean, so much it looked really jarring, and she plucked her eyebrows really, really thin. I'm pretty sure she was a good few years younger than Wynn, but the way she made herself up made it seem like she was 20 or 30 years older and was just trying to look younger. Maggie was famous for sitting out on their porch and knitting, which I think contributed to the whole old person vibe she gave off. Only she didn't really ever seem to be knitting anything. I remember walking our dog around the neighborhood and getting a look at the tangled mess of yarn she just seemed to be poking needles into. It was like a lime green spider web, just a tangle of thread she stared at like she was in some kind of trance. She also had this talent for turning super happy sounding innocent nursery rhymes into the creepiest sounding things, singing them all slow and deliberate in a sing-song voice that sounded like a combination of a creaking door and nails on a chalkboard. I remember one time when we got some of their mail delivered to our house by mistake, and my mom made me go over to drop it off. Mrs. Ward was sitting on their porch, poking these dirty-looking knitting needles into a tangle of yarn and singing. Ring around the rosy, a pocket full of posies, ashes, ashes, we all fall down. When she looked up to see me standing there with the mail in my hand, she acted all scared, which was nuts because I think I was way more freaked out to be over there. But she thanked me for bringing the mail over anyway. Yet before I turned to leave, she asked me if I knew what nursery rhyme she was singing. I nodded, and she asked if I knew what the origins were. I said no. And she went on to explain to me that the song had its roots in some old plague that had swept across England. I think she meant the Black Death, but I can't be certain. She said the ring around the rosy part was a reference to a rash that was a symptom of the disease, and a posy was a collection of herbs that was carried to mask the scent of rot that the dying people were said to have given off. Then she tells me that the all fall down part was a reference to people dying from the plague. I don't know how true any of that is, but Jesus, it freaked me out to have her tell me that in her weird scratchy voice with her face all painted up like some circus clown. Their younger son, Jacob Ward, was a total freak. He was obsessed with Native American culture, which I'm not saying is a bad thing at all, but Jacob was totally toxic about it. It was rare that you'd see that kid and he didn't have his face painted or have this grim homemade headdress on or whatever. He also liked to run around with a bow and arrow that his parents insisted was totally harmless and used those cartoony sucker tip arrows. But there are a lot of people, myself included, that swear that they'd seen him using actual sharp tip arrows on a handful of occasions. He'd aim them at you, pull the drawstring back to the point you'd actually run for cover, but he never seemed to fire any, and you could never catch him using them whenever there were any grown-ups around. I actually got a social worker called over at some point because a few people had seen Jacob walking around with dead squirrels or pigeons. I'm not sure if he'd shoot them himself with his bow and arrow or they were just roadkill or something, but it was alarmingly enough to enough people that they actually had a visit from someone. Although whether or not that actually came to anything, I don't know. Then finally, their older son was this kid named Johnny. Johnny was the kind of kid that growled at people in high school when they got too close to him, and before he got expelled for fighting, did something seriously messed up. Apparently he asked this girl to go out on a date, some super pretty but super nerdy girl who happened to be his lab partner. She says no, and Johnny doesn't take it very well at all. He made things difficult for her during chemistry by not talking or looking at her, and eventually she had to basically beg the teacher to switch partners so she could even get a passing grade. Not long after, she was driving back from school in her seemingly empty car when she looks in the rearview mirror to see Johnny just sitting in her back seat, grinning at her. He'd apparently broken into her car and hidden in the footwell in her back seat under some blankets or something. Or at least that's what we all figured he'd done. She was so scared she crashed her car and had to spend a week in the hospital. All Johnny got was a visit from the cops and a warning to stay away from her, and somehow it was all just blamed on teenage hijinks. I think maybe because the girl's family were too scared of the warts to press charges or whatever. I'm sure there's more to that story, but that's all I know of that. When the for sale sign finally showed up from the ward's house, I think Dark Hollow was about ready to throw a big party to celebrate them leaving, and after they did, they became something of an urban legend, basically a campfire tale that only a handful of people really knew was actually true and not something we made up to scare people. Like, I still think it's a miracle that there wasn't any bigger drama to happen involving the wards, something like a murder or whatever, little Jacob shooting someone with an actual arrow. I know Johnny basically almost killed his lab partner in that car crash, but somehow they never actually went through with seriously hurting anyone. But who knows, maybe a couple more years and there would have been a fatality. And who knows what they've been up to, wherever they moved to. Maybe it's only a matter of time before they seriously hurt someone. Me and my mother were driving through our small town in Southwest Virginia. My mother and father are divorced, and he lives in Tennessee. They had very different viewpoints on helping out hitchhikers, as my dad was very much into hiking, camping, etc., but there was a woman walking down the road. Mind you, it's very hot outside. It's the summertime, and I noticed she was carrying a child swaddled up in a blanket, which struck me as a poor choice considering it was the middle of summer. Just seems too warm for a swaddle. So I say to my mom, we really need to pick that lady up. Surely she isn't far from where she needs to go, but she's got a baby. And to my surprise, my mom pulls into the gas station parking lot, tells me to go in and get a large bottle of water, and we'll ask her if she'd like a ride. So we pull out of the gas station and approach the thin, almost sickly-looking woman, and she very quietly just grabbed the door handle and got inside. Not saying anything at all, not even a thank you, which really didn't sit right with me because this is the South. Everyone is friendly and approachable, for the most part. So, we ask where she's needing to go, and me being in the passenger seat, I turn to look at her, and she's looking down at her baby and cooing at it. She replies without ever looking up from the swaddle being about 2 miles past the Dollar General and Jeb Stuart, and we were very close to that area. I decided to turn and speak to the woman, maybe get a conversation going, but as I get a better look at her baby, it actually was a drywall hammer wrapped up in a blanket inside another blanket. I froze. It was like I walked into a deep freezer. I told my mom that I really think we should stop because I hear what sounds like knocking, and was very adamant. We needed to stop at the upcoming Dollar General. As we pull in, I told my mom to get out of the car, that I needed her help to locate the noise, and we met each other at the hood of the car where I told her, Mom, that's not a baby. She's got a hammer in that blanket. to which my mother advised me that we should walk inside to see if they had anything to help close that up, and told the woman we would be right back. We walked inside and told them to call the police so they could help this woman that we could no longer have in our vehicle, and explained why. My mother gave her some vague reason as to why we couldn't take her further, and she got out of the vehicle very angrily, but almost confused, and we left her in that parking lot. She very well could have just been a really confused woman, maybe with some mental issues, but I don't know what was going on with her, but I do know that I don't think she had good intentions for us. This happened on Halloween of 2019. My friends and I were feeling the spooky vibes of the month and wanted to do something fun and exciting to satisfy our thirst. Being the dumb college students that we were, we decided on exploring somewhere allegedly haunted in the hopes of seeing some genuine paranormal activity. Since we're from Illinois, the popular destination of Bachelor's Grove Cemetery immediately came to mind, and it was settled upon. Once the sun had set and night had fallen, we were to make our move, sneaking into the cemetery after it closed to get the full experience without having to worry about any other visitors. I must admit, I always wanted to do something like this before, but I was genuinely afraid of what might be waiting for us in that cemetery so late at night. Stories always circulated around the various apparitions people had encountered before, the different sounds that chilled them to the bone, and so on. Anyway, all of this was festering inside of me well before we actually started driving over to the cemetery sometime in the evening. It was a pleasantly long drive, but I wasn't really in the mood to think about anything else except for the potential horrors that roam the cemetery for all eternity, or so they say. Couple in the fact that we were going to be trespassing in order to get through in the first place, and I was a nervous wreck. My friends were apparently doing a much better job at keeping their fears in check, though. For the sake of the story, I'll call them Logan, Paul, and Eddie. The entire car ride there, they were laughing and joking around, not worried about what we would be getting into or what we might see. Looking back at the whole situation, I should have known that their optimism was a bad sign. No way would we have been able to explore this place without them being the slightest bit nervous. But what's done is done. A little past seven, once night had finally fallen for real and darkness went on in every direction for as far as the eye could see, we arrived. Parking in the main parking lot was out of the question, because we did some looking into it and found that in previous years, local law enforcement liked to wait there and catch any would-be explorers before they could even get inside, so we had a backup plan. Since the actual cemetery was located in the center of a dense forest on all sides, essentially forming a square where all the roads would go around it, we were to park at some restaurant that was open super late and had a huge parking lot, all the way in the back, furthest away from the restaurant itself and closest to the road. This was in the exact opposite direction from the front entrance of the cemetery, so we figured this was our best chance of getting in while avoiding any cops in our way. From there, we'd cross the street on foot and have a bit of a walk before arriving at a somewhat hidden path leading into the forest. Taking this back path would take a bit more to get to the actual cemetery itself, since there were trees particularly thick and dense, but it was well worth it when considering the alternative. After everything was said and done, we found ourselves beginning our trek onto the path, unsure of how far we'd actually have to go before we find what we were looking for. It was a windy night, and even though it wasn't especially cold or anything, I still remember my teeth chattering and my skin going cold. Aside from the occasional sounds of leaves being crunched under our shoes as we walked, there was absolute silence. My once cheerful and energetic friends were now, all of a sudden, quiet and subdued. Logan in particular had this odd expression on his face, it being illuminated by my phone's flashlight as we walked. It was some sort of cross between fear and pain, like every step he took was causing him physical harm. Before I could question him about it, we found ourselves at our destination. Here we were, in the heart of Bachelor's Grove, with graves all around us and a certain chill in the air. Everyone split up to cover more ground, promising to call the others over if they were to encounter something. I didn't want us going too far away from one another, but I also didn't want to seem like a complete baby, so I kept my mouth shut and began exploring. Most of the graves I looked at had withered away from time and the elements, so I couldn't really make out anything that was on the tombstones. The few dates that I could read went back to the late 1800s, and a sinking feeling in my stomach started once I realized these people had been dead and decaying in the ground for over 100 years. Feeling extremely uncomfortable with this realization, I began to back away from the graves and start to look for my friends to see if they had found anything supernatural. Yet when all of a sudden, I heard it. Not just me, either. All of us did. It was a low, almost unnoticeable if you weren't paying attention, but with the way our senses were heightened, there was no way we would miss it. It appeared to be some sort of chanting, and it sounded like it was coming a little bit north from our direction, further in a clearing. I couldn't make any of the words being spoken or if it was even in English, but there was something creepy about the tone, like it was religious and the chanting was some sort of prayer. The voice that was doing the chanting was deep and gravelly, belonging to some man that we couldn't see. The four of us shone our lights on each other to see our expressions, and at that moment, we knew what we were going to do. Despite every fiber in my being telling me not to go any further and see what the source of this chanting was, my curiosity got the better of me and I couldn't resist. Eddie whispered to us to turn our lights off completely, while he dimmed his just enough to where it wouldn't attract too much attention, but we would still be able to see with it. The next few moments we spent creeping towards the noise, the more and more I started to lose it. My breathing was uncontrollable, and it felt like my heart was beating a million miles an hour. I was so afraid of what we would find, and yet I still had to know. Finally, after what seemed like an eternity, we had entered the clearing and were a mere few steps away from this chanting. Eddie shone his light in the direction ahead of us, and for just a brief moment, we saw a cloaked figure bent over something in the grass, still chanting in that unrecognizable language. The thing in the grass looked like some sort of circle with a mark in the center, and I swear to God, I wish I could tell you I'm lying about this, but when I realized what the symbol was, I felt like throwing up. There was no mistake. It was a pentagram, made of some strange material. For the moment that Eddie had illuminated the sight in front of us, I had been able to get a glimpse of the pentagram's material being bright red, and I shouldn't have to say any more about that. Once the light from Eddie's phone hit the back of the man's head, he immediately stopped chanting and stood up, still facing the direction of the pentagram. I can only describe the next few minutes as truly unadulterated terror. Before we knew it, he screamed a blood-curdling scream that rattled us to the core and turned around, beginning to sprint towards us. Everything happened so fast. I couldn't even make out the man's facial features except for deep, sunken eyes and an expression that radiated pure hatred. He really did want to bring us harm. And not wasting any time, we all fled the direction we came from and ran faster than I think any of us had ever ran in our entire lives. I couldn't even scream while running. I was too petrified to make any noise. Maybe it was a miracle, but we somehow managed to retrace our steps all the way through the path we took to enter the cemetery and forest, and eventually came out the main road, which was devoid of any traffic for the time being. Afraid of what I would see if I looked back, I made a beeline for the car along with the others and hopped into the back seat, not wasting any time to lock the door and roll up the window. We peeled out of there in no time flat and didn't stop driving 20 over the speed limit until we were at least 10 minutes away. Honestly, I have no idea how far or how long that man chased us, but I do know this for sure. We weren't supposed to be there that night, and we must have been interrupting something important of his. I'll never know what it was, and honestly, I don't hope to ever find out. We never did talk about this experience again after that night, and we never went on another trip to somewhere abandoned or haunted ever again, either. I think that fright we felt is enough to satisfy us for the rest of our lives, and I'm thankful beyond words that we all managed to get out together, alive. So I recently moved to Charlotte after the passing of my father in August in Charleston. I had also ended a relationship and just wanted to be on my own and living in a city. I moved to a nice apartment with a fireplace. The apartment felt good when I tore it in and moved in. After the first few weeks, I began to have strange feelings. Leaving the shower, getting changed in, and waking for water or pee in the middle of the night gave me the feeling that I had guests in the main room. I remember waking up one night and believing someone was sleeping on my couch. Before I went out there, I made sure to put on a shirt and pants because I didn't want to freak out my guests by being in the buff. As time went on, I found myself more and more self-conscious about what doors I left open, like someone was there and I didn't want to give them a show. This continued and almost has become worse. I'll occasionally shower and I can hear the sounds of someone getting ready in the bathroom. It also feels like a female getting ready or in the other room. After that, the dreams came, almost weekly. I've had dreams discussing with this entity that they needed to go. Now I sleep through anything, so what I found weird was, after these dreams, I would spring awake and feel like someone was in the room with me or the entry to the room. It often reminded me of having to talk with a roommate who is hanging out in your doorway. After a few minutes, the feeling would subside like they left and I'd go back to bed. These dreams continued, oftentimes leading to shouting matches where I was demanding it left. About 3 weeks ago, things picked up a bit. Between the dreams and now, I've had a few more situations where I felt like someone was with me in the apartment and ended up buying a bathrobe. One night 3 weeks ago, she and I had a discussion in the dream. It was a positive dream, but she wouldn't tell me what she wanted. I snapped awake and felt like someone was close, like near the bed close. After a minute of contemplating my options, I spoke out loud that I was leaving. I heard a sigh in my ear like someone was next to my bed. I was terrified. I threw the bathrobe on and drove around for about an hour. I decided I wouldn't acknowledge her or it and just go on with my life. 2 days later, I saw her. I was cleaning the house and doing laundry. My laundry room is a closet off the kitchen. I was in the laundry room in my boxer socks and a tee sorting laundry at the time. I got the feeling that someone had just come in the front door. Milliseconds later, I look at the other side of the kitchen and saw a woman standing there. I screamed crazy loud and she was gone. She wasn't in any crazy old clothes from the Victorian era. Actually, she looked like she was wearing a blue and white 80s-ish shirt and some jeans. I'm mad that I panicked because I couldn't see her face before she was gone. I was mad, so I started addressing her. First, I would tell her I needed to sleep tonight and to leave me alone. A few days later, I asked for a sign. Stupid, I know. Well, I have this antique bell thing, and after running out for food, I came home and found it rolling across my floor in front of me. There's no way it could have left its location without force. Since then, I see her more and more. I've gone back to ignoring, but it doesn't help. She hasn't done anything malicious or destructive, just is here. I'm kind of stumped on how to handle this and just weirded out. Update, March 12th, 2019. So I did some exploring in this area. Without giving too much away, my complex is long and winding. I've never been to the other side because I don't need to go that way as I'm close to the main road. Well, on the other side of the complex, within a tenth of a mile, is a massive high-tension wires, the huge power lines, and a substation below it. On that station is a cell tower. I know nothing about the paranormal besides what I've researched and seen on TV, but could there be some electromagnetism fields or something from there? Not sure, but it was a thought. Also, there is a small brook in the area. On that other side of the complex is a standalone ER. From that area with the power stuff, I can see almost directly into the ambulance bay of an ER. Not sure what it means, but it was an interesting location. There have been no major traumas in the area that I could find, but I spoke to maintenance about the unit and it seems all the tenants leave after a year. Now, we have a decent transient population moving here for work and school, so maybe just a lot of energy left in the place. They said no major complaints or sudden move-outs. I bought Sage on Amazon, and that is coming, so I'll let everyone know about that, and I'm looking for a psychic or medium for a session, but have no idea how to vet someone for this. Any tips would be welcome. The apartment feels quiet today. I've been keeping music on low and some lights on during the darker hours before bed, mainly the hallway light. Also, I only have one window and a huge slider, but I've kept the shades open on both to let some light in. Not sure what it does, but makes me feel good. Finally, I'd like to say thank you for everyone that's responded. I've never gone through something like this or anything even remotely close to it, so thank you for the helpful comments and the occasional joke to lighten the mood. This has been an unnerving ordeal so far, and being pointed in the right path is calming. Zachary Latham and his neighbors, the Durham family, did not get along. They lived opposite each other on the Thornhill Road in Vineland, New Jersey, a town of about 60,000 located 40 miles south of Philadelphia. After being forced to live with his grandparents at the age of 16, the Durhams initially found Zach to be a boisterous but polite young man. But as the years went by, neither he nor the Durhams had a good word to say about one another, and ultimately, the mutual animosity came to a head because of Zach's erratic style of driving. William Durham, along with his wife Catherine, had accused their 18-year-old neighbor of reckless driving on more than one occasion, and what was intended to be a friendly word with the young man quickly soured into a confrontation. When first approached by Mr. and Mrs. Durham, instead of responding amicably to their concerns, Zach responded by pulling out his cell phone. He then spitefully accused Mrs. Durham of being a Karen and swore at an enraged Mr. Durham when he objected to his behavior. Any chance of a peaceful coexistence went straight out of the window when Zach told the couple he'd be posting the video online. And post it he did, with the video going on to be viewed more than 3 million times by TikTok users around the world. What followed was an escalating feud that was later described as a powder keg. The confrontations between Zach and the Durham family were bad enough beforehand, but the publicity Zach had garnered meant that complete strangers were pouring gasoline on an already blazing fire. Hundreds of comments on the TikTok video of the argument between Zach and the Durhams urged him to cut her tires, egg her house, or the ominously vague, go after her. Apparently, a few weeks after the recorded confrontation, Mr. and Miss Durham were minding their own business and getting on with some housework when Zach pulled up next to them in his car. Hey, Karen, he is reported to have cried out. We went viral, Karen. I made you famous. The exposure had a terrible effect on the Durhams' mental health and were even recognized around their New Jersey hometown, much to their chagrin. They sought out an injunction against the video, but were told by the police that they could not sign a complaint against Mr. Latham since the courts were closed because of the coronavirus pandemic. Then, on May 4th of 2020, Mr. and Mrs. Durham returned home from some grocery shopping to discover that Zach Latham had deliberately swerved his pickup truck at their son, who was out in the street riding his bicycle. Mr. Durham was furious. Humiliating him and his wife with online videos was one thing, but to threaten his son's safety was another thing entirely. He marched out of his house, got into his truck, and parked it right behind Zach's own vehicle, blocking him into his own driveway. And on that occasion, it was Zach's wife who was filming the exchange when he walked out of his home to confront Mr. Durham. Both were absolutely livid as they demanded to know what Zach was thinking when he nearly hit their boy. But Zach was in no mood to talk. He told the couple that they had better back up because they were not going to like what's coming out, referring to something he had inside his house. When Mr. Durham got a little too close to Zach, he threw a punch. It missed, but it was enough to have the Durhams' two teenage sons stepping in to try to defend their father. It was then that Zach grabbed a stun gun and knife from under the driver's seat of his truck, firing the taser at the two boys after swinging at them with the knife. Mr. Durham then grabbed Zach in a misguided attempt to disarm him, who was lithe and fast enough to shake the older man off before slashing his right arm with a knife. With Mr. Durham bleeding profusely from the knife wound, Zack attempted to retreat into his garage, but the red mist had descended on his older neighbor, with Mr. Durham following him into the garage, cursing up a storm and promising to kill him. A courtroom later heard that a brief but violent melee then ensued, one in which Durham was repeatedly shocked with a taser. Zack's young wife begged him to drop the knife, but despite her pleading, Zack plunged the tip of the knife into an area just below Mr. Durham's armpit, a stab wound which punctured his lung and caused it to fill with blood. The 51-year-old correctional officer died that night, with Zack being arrested at his grandparents' home just hours later. During his trial for murder, the prosecution was particularly interested in why Zack's wife had been so quick to pull out her phone to record the confrontation. And throughout hours of questioning and evidence examination, it was determined that Zack and his wife had frequently discussed the idea of recording another viral confrontation with the Durhams, one that would grow their already sizable TikTok following, and the one that could make them some money. In a phrase, the court established that Zack had manufactured the confrontation so he could become TikTok famous. If Latham was in fear for his or Sarah's safety, they both would have retreated inside, called police, and stayed there, the prosecuting attorney stated. They did not because their intent was to lure the Durhams there, attack them, and record it for TikTok. But Zachary's defense attorney painted a very different picture of the night's events, insisting that it was, in fact, his client that was the victim in the situation, given that the Durhams had ventured onto his property to instigate violence. A recording of his 911 call was played to the court, and this is what they heard. "Yeah, I need the cops out here. There's blood all over the place. I just got assaulted and jumped. I got beat up really bad and I have blood all over me. They came with trucks, came on my property with guns, and then when I fought them off, they drove away." It was a strong argument, but one that paled in comparison to the prosecution's own, which was ironically fueled by Zack's own actions. Since his arrest, Zack wasted no opportunity to grow his TikTok following by talking about the incident and broadcast to his thousands of followers. In the videos, he professes his innocence and insists that the killing was nothing but self-defense, arguing that he was merely a young man defending the home of his grandparents from armed intruders. But there was a distinctly darker side to the videos too, as Zack seemed content to whip up a frenzy of malcontent to direct at the Durhams and their friends. Zack's followers have been alleged to have harassed the Durhams directly, even going so far as to post their address in one video's comment section. Zack posted so frequently that, in the end, a Superior Court judge approved an order prohibiting him from making public remarks about the case, essentially silencing him before any trial can begin. This is most definitely something that's going to be used against Zack in his upcoming murder trial. The prosecution could well argue that his obsession with social media popularity pushed him to create more and more drama with a family that simply couldn't take his behavior any longer. Zack has documented his harassment of the Durhams. He filmed himself pushing a regularly suburban family to their limits, and when they finally snapped, he had someone ready to film that too. It seems that Zack is a young man with a very troubling upbringing, which included a juvenile criminal history and a penchant for violence. Whether or not you believe that Zack was just defending himself, or that he manufactured the confrontation, he has most certainly used his notoriety to foster a larger TikTok following, and that is something that is going to reflect very badly on him during his trial. Some people will do anything to be famous, but whether or not Zack killed a father of two over something as fickle as fame is something only a jury can now decide. Just to give some context, I'm currently in the UK, and the town where I live in is known for its drug scene, but doesn't have a violent crime problem to speak of. I think that's why I found what happened so shocking, because I lived in London before, and while some messed up stuff did happen to me there, it was nowhere near the level of what happened to me earlier this year. My partner and I live together in our flat, which is in a relatively busy residential area. I work from home, however, and he's out of the flat quite a lot, so I guess it might look to an outside observer like I live alone. Our flat complex was once an old factory, and we have these huge industrial windows, so people walking on the street have a pretty clear view of our dining room, which is where I work during the day. It all started in July of this year. I'm ashamed to say that I can be a major rubbernecker, and a lot of drama occurs on the road outside of our flat, so I look out of the windows often during my workday for some light entertainment. The best was a two-hour breakup I got to watch unfold in the car just below our window, but that's besides the point. One day, I got up to make myself a cup of tea, looked out of the kitchen window, and saw this guy just staring at me. I was struck by how intense it was and how he didn't look away, even when it was obvious that I was looking back at him. I felt creeped out by it, and I tried not to let it bother me. We have a lot of drug addicts and other weird characters that hang out around here, so it didn't seem like such a big deal. I went back to work, and by the time I'd sat down at the table, he was gone. About a week later, my partner had gone to visit his dad for the weekend, so I was excited to hunker down and catch up on some of my favorite shows alone. After about 30 minutes, the buzzer to the flat went. The buzzer is so loud and scared the heck out of me. I was lucky my popcorn didn't go flying out of my hands. Now, our flat complex has this big porch where teenagers and addicts love to hang out because it provides shelter from the rain and about four people can sit down inside of it. Sometimes people lean up on the buzzers by accident when they're hanging out in the porch, so I assumed that was what happened. After a few seconds, however, the buzzer went again, and again, and again. Someone was pressing it in this rhythmic pattern. It's something I know my partner does when he's forgotten his keys, and it's kind of our code for me to let him in, which is why I found it so disconcerting. At first, I was worried he might have missed the bus to his dad's house and had decided to come back to the flat. I was nearly about to buzz him straight in when I thought it would be a good idea to pick up the phone first and check who it was. As soon as I picked up the phone, the person standing near the intercom must have heard because they said, "Hello?" It was definitely not my partner. I asked who it was and why they were buzzing the flat so late at night, but all they said was, "Can you let me in?" I asked them why they wanted to come in and they said, "You invited me, remember?" While they were talking, they kept kind of laughing under their breath, and the whole exchange put me on edge. I told them I had no idea who they were and just hung up. I was expecting them to start pressing the buzzer again, but they didn't. After a few minutes, I crept out of the flat to have a look at who was on the porch, but they were gone. My partner has to get up early for work, whereas I'm more of a night owl. Most nights, I'm up until about 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. working on my laptop while he's asleep. A few nights after the intercom incident, I was on my laptop watching YouTube videos and realized that we'd forgotten to take the trash out. This happens a lot, and it's not uncommon for me to take the trash out at around 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. At least it wasn't until all this happened. I put my slippers on, grabbed the bag of trash, and took it out to the curb outside the flat's main entrance. When I looked across the street, there was this guy standing on the opposite street corner. He was watching me, and his eyes followed me all the way from the front door to the curb. I noticed he was smoking, so I assumed he lived in one of the houses across the street. I remember even thinking, wouldn't it be creepy if he tried to come over here? As I put the trash bag down, I caught a glimpse of movement out of the corner of my eye. I looked up and saw him walking in a straight line across the road towards me, with his eyes fixed on me the entire time. I don't know how to describe it, but the look on his face filled me with this instinctive sense of dread. It felt like someone had just turned my stomach inside out. I pulled my keys out of my hoodie pocket, turned around, and ran to the front door. I've never felt that kind of fear before, and it was like my body was compelling me to get as far away from this man as possible. I got into the building, slammed the door behind me, and rushed to my flat without looking back. I didn't want to know whether he followed me or not. I told my partner about the whole thing the next day and how shook up I was. We agreed that we'd be more proactive with trash, and I've never taken it out late at night again. Fast forward to the beginning of August, about 2 weeks after the trash incident, and I'd pretty much forgotten all about it. I was still too scared to go out late at night on the road, but nothing weird had happened since then. I went to bed at about 2 a.m., but I felt restless for some reason and struggled to get to sleep. By about 3 a.m., I was contemplating whether or not to give up and go do something else when I heard the scream. The sound cut right through me. There was something visceral about the terror in that scream. I knew it was bad because my partner went from stone cold asleep to being up in a shot. He asked me what it was, and I said I didn't know. I went to the window straight away and looked out. Down one of the side roads near our flat, I could see headlights, but I couldn't get a clear view of the car. The screaming continued in bursts, and after a while, I could make out words. It was a woman, and she was saying something like, get out," over and over again. I'm used to hearing all kinds of domestic arguments take place on the road outside of our flat, particularly since we're near the university and several popular bars. But this is different. There was this raw fear in her voice that made the hairs on my arm stand up. I turned to my partner and said I had to call the police. When they picked up and I explained what was happening, they seemed disinterested at first, but the operator's tone changed when I told them where it was. I think they must have been getting calls from all around the area about it. It was sometime during this phone call that I heard a screech of tires and the screaming stopped. The operator asked me to go to the window and describe to them what was happening. When I looked down, there was this black car sat on the road. One of the neighbors from across the road was speaking to the two guys in the car. I had to twist to get a good look at them, but one of the guys in the car looked uncannily like the guy who had been watching me when I was putting out the trash that time. At first, the conversation seemed congenial, but it took a turn when the neighbor asked them some sort of question that I couldn't quite hear clearly, and they sped off down the road. With no less than 10 minutes, three police cars arrived and had blocked off the roads leading to our flat, our residential areas on a grid system. They were knocking on doors and asking to speak to all of our neighbors. I told my partner that we should go out and speak to them, and since we saw a lot of what happened and my partner had had the foresight to write down the license plate of the black car. When we went out, there were these two girls talking to one of the police officers. They were both shaking, and one of them looked as though they had been crying. I decided to stand nearby and wait for the girls to finish before speaking with the officer myself. What they said made my blood run cold. They were from one of the houses that looked out directly onto the road where I had seen the headlights, so they had a clear view of what had happened. Like us, they had been alerted by the screaming and gone straight to the window. From what they could gather, the black car had cut off a small red car on the road. I pulled right in front of it, and that's what had caused the girl driving the red car to scream the first time. They thought it might have been some kind of misunderstanding, but then they watched as one of the guys from the black car got out, walked to the red car, and jumped in through the window. That's the point when the girl must have been screaming, "Get out, get out." There had been a struggle, and the girl watching said they assumed the guy was just trying to steal the car, but then he forced the driver into the back seat, and that's when he drove off. The two girls were both hysterical by this point, and you could tell they felt guilty for not intervening. I could feel that same guilt seeping into my thoughts as well. After the guy had driven off in the red car, the two men in the black car had gone the opposite way and turned the corner onto our road, but had been stopped by another neighbor. Although this neighbor had been alerted by the screaming, he hadn't actually witnessed what happened, so he had stopped the black car to ask the guy what was going on without knowing they were involved, and that was the exchange we saw. When the guys started acting suspicious, he asked them if they would wait for the police to arrive, and that's the point when they took off. It wasn't until we got back to the flat that I started to put two and two together. I have a small red car, just like the one that the girls had described, and I normally come back at night on that day of the week since it's the day I go to visit my parents. I had only come back early on this particular occasion because I needed to let a plumber in to do some work on the flat. What if they had been waiting for me, and they had gotten the wrong car? Over the next few days, I contacted the police several times and checked the local news, but I never heard anything about the girl who was kidnapped. I still have no idea what happened to her, and all I know is that they found her car abandoned somewhere not far from where she was taken, but she wasn't in it. It still gives me chills just thinking about it. How far would you go to find a missing family member? Is there anything you wouldn't do, or anywhere you wouldn't go in order to recover a loved one? For many of us, the answer will be a resounding no. We'd do anything for the people close to us. And that's exactly how Sarah Turney felt regarding the disappearance of her older sister, Alyssa, in the year 2001. Over the years, Sarah tried almost every means at her disposal in her quest for answers. She started Facebook and Instagram accounts dedicated to spreading awareness of Alyssa's absence. She started a blog called Justice for Alyssa, which kept track of the ongoing investigations. She reached out to multiple media outlets, both regional and national, actually managing to bag an appearance on Dateline NBC. She started her own podcast, appeared as a guest on other people's, and even attended CrimeCon, the weekend-long event for true crime fans as well as those desperate for leads. She left no stone unturned in her search for justice, but unfortunately, she had no luck in the search for her missing sister. Then, in Sarah's desperation, she turned to TikTok. Sarah later said that she started a TikTok account because she wanted to reach a young audience that hadn't heard about Alyssa's case before. She made sure her video posts included as little of her own speculation and theory as possible, making sure to present only the facts to her new audience. However, she did make it clear that one particular line of inquiry had been almost completely neglected. Her father, Michael Turney, who adopted Alyssa after her mother had died, had never been considered a serious suspect. After announcing she created a TikTok page dedicated to spreading awareness about Alyssa, she also included a word or two about the people who'd had less than positive things to say about it. She made very clear that no matter what anyone said about TikTok or any other medium, if it helped her get closer to answers surrounding Alyssa's disappearance, it would all be worth it. It was all part of her doing the right thing and fighting for justice. To her astonishment, Sarah quickly gained over 1 million followers on the video app, with each new video post giving her more and more of an audience. In one particular video, Sarah gives a full and frank account of the day her older sister disappeared. At the time, both girls were living with her father, Michael, since their mother, Barbara, had died of cancer. It was her last day of junior year at Paradise Valley High School in Phoenix, Arizona. Sarah, who was 12 years old at the time, says she found her sister's usually neat, tidy bedroom looking like it had been struck by a bomb. It was a total mess. The only sign of Alyssa was her Nokia cell phone that was left on the dresser, along with a note saying she'd gone to California to try to make it on her own. In another video, she talked about why exactly she had such a strong hunch that her father was to blame. And needless to say, Michael Turney was much more of a dark personality than he liked to let on. Because 7 years after Alyssa first went missing, Phoenix Police Department made a rather worrying discovery at Michael's home whilst on a completely separate investigation. A stash of 26 homemade pipe bombs, 3 incendiary devices, and 2 silencers. After he had such volatile equipment confiscated, Michael allowed himself to be interviewed by ABC News. During the interview, he told journalists that he had been planning to take his own life in order to bring attention to Alyssa's case, but added that the bombs found in his home had actually been planted there by police officers attempting to frame him for his daughter's disappearance, which he denied having anything to do with. They have no proof whatsoever of anything other than rumors, innuendos, and lies. There's only 2 people that can confirm whether I did it, and one is me, and the other is Alyssa. Alyssa's not here, and I'm sitting here, and all I can say until hell freezes over, I didn't do a thing to my daughter. In March of 2010, Michael pleaded guilty to possession of the unregistered pipe bombs and was sentenced to 7 years in prison for owning the explosives and all the silencers. Since April of last year, Sarah has been uploading TikToks about her father's alleged role in Alyssa's disappearance. In one particular video that has accrued over 13 million views, she shared home VHS footage from March 29, 1997, 4 years before Alyssa went missing. In another TikTok, Sarah plays what she claims is a recorded conversation she had with her father a few months after he got out of prison in 2017. The meeting took place at a Starbucks and lasted for over an hour. I felt a lot of different emotions afterwards, Sarah says. I was sad that he still refused to give me any answers, I was hoping that putting those statements on TikTok would prompt the police to finally bring him to a grand jury for questioning. In February 2019, the case was formally submitted to the county attorney's office requesting homicide charges to be made against Michael, but there was no telling if it would actually be taken seriously or not. It would take another 6 months for the attorney to make a decision. Until then, all anyone could do was wait. Then, to the shock of almost everyone involved in the case, Michael Turney was indicted on charges of murdering his own daughter. Maricopa County Attorney Alistair Adele did not elaborate on what exact evidence led to Mr. Turney's arrest, but did confirm that the indictment was issued by a grand jury. She also credited Sarah Turney and her TikToks with having helped solve the case. Sarah Turney, your perseverance and commitment to finding justice for your sister Alyssa is a testament to the love of a sister, and because of that love, Alyssa's light has never gone out, and she lives on in the stories and photos you've shared with the community, Adele said. This passion you have demonstrated to her during your journey is something that will keep Alyssa's memory alive forever. Sarah had said she will continue to make TikTok videos about Alyssa's case until her killer is brought to justice, and whether or not that killer is her own father remains to be seen. Every evening after work, she scans all of her social media accounts on TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, plus her blog to see whether anyone has come forward with new information or tips. And then she sits down with the thousands of documents she's acquired that relate to Alyssa's case. I read through approximately 3,000 pages of case documents that were released to the public by the police and gone through a few hundred hours of home footage, video, and interviews that I've conducted with Alyssa's friends and family, she says. And no, I won't ever stop. Sarah and Alyssa's story is truly inspirational. A search for justice fueled by the love between two sisters. It's a reminder that those close to us will never stop fighting in our corner, even after we're long gone. But it's also a reminder that sometimes it's that those close to us can also be the ones that hurt us the most.
Sinister Babysitter. My name is Brian. This terrible incident happened to me when I was 9 years old. At that time, I was just a little child that could not understand anything. My school holidays were going on those days. My parents wanted to go to Paris for outings and fun, but my father did not want to take me with him. That day, my father was talking to my mother that I was still very young. If we take him along, we'll not be able to enjoy it in Paris. Then my mother called her sister Janet and said, Janet, can you come here to my house in 2 days to take care of Brian? Because both of us are going to Paris for a week on outings. But she refused because she was busy in her job for the next 6 days, and she advised my mother to hire a babysitter for me for a few days. My mother told my father about Janet's advice. He said, "That is a brilliant idea." He instantly called someone, maybe it was his friend, and said that he needed a babysitter for a week. He arranged it as soon as possible. I don't know how, but my father found a babysitter for me very quickly. The next morning, the doorbell rang. There was a beautiful girl named Olive at the door. She was smiling. She was a babysitter. She entered and sat on the chair. My parents were also sitting there, and all of them were talking. I was watching her from a little distance. My mother told her about my eating habits and all my stuff, etc. My father was continuously gazing at her. She agreed to babysit. After some time, she left. That same night, I saw my mother packing their baggage. I went to my room. My mother came to me. I was very sad because my parents were going to Paris without me. My mother pampered me. Brian, you are such a smart boy. Don't disturb your babysitter, Olive. And don't forget to eat while playing. I love you, my baby. The next morning, Olive came. My parents left the house because they had to go to the airport. Olive was taking care of me. She was not so bad. She used to play with me. The next day, Olive was talking on the phone. I was watching TV. She came to me and said, Brian, it is your father on the call. Talk to him. Then I talked to my father and mother. I gave her back the phone and she continued on the call for an hour. Another day, Olive was in the kitchen. Her phone was on the table. I was watching TV. Then her phone rang. I saw the number on the phone. It was my father's number. I picked up the call.
Dad, when will you come home? I miss you.
Then Olive came and she snatched the phone from my hand. Then she continued for a long time. All this continued for 5 days. After 5 days, early in the morning, I came out of my room. I saw my father sitting on the chair with Olive. I was happy to see him. I hugged him and said,
"You were supposed to come back after 7 days, but you arrived early. Very good. And where's Mom?"
He told me, "I reached here last night, but you were sleeping. Your mother is with her sister, Janet. She will be here soon." My father was not looking happy to me. Olive was looking at my father and smiling. I didn't know, but something was weird. My father got close to Olive, hired her, and then went to the office. Olive was looking after me the whole day as before. At night, my father came. We three had dinner. I was missing my mom. Her chair was empty. Then after some time, it was time to sleep. Olive said goodnight to me and went to my father's room. My father also followed her and locked the door. It seemed odd. That was my mom's place. I was so sad but helpless. My father used to treat Olive as he treated my mother before. Next day was Sunday. Olive and my father were watching TV and laughing. My father said, "Brian, we're going out to the amusement park and we'll be back after 5 or 6 hours. I said, "Okay, Father, I'm going to get ready."
"Brian, you're not going anywhere. Olive is going with me."
Olive said,
"Your breakfast is there in the kitchen with some fruits, ice cream, and snacks are in the refrigerator, okay?"
Then they both left in the car. After 1 hour, the doorbell rang. I opened the door. It was Janet. I hugged her and started crying. I looked out here and there and then said,
"Where's my mom? Why didn't you bring her with you? My father told me that she's with you." "What? But I came here to meet you and her."
We both were shocked. Then I told her everything that my father said and what they both, Olive and my father, were doing. Then she went to my parents' room and checked something. She found my mom's baggage. Then she said, "She's been here." Then she was running all over the house and searching for something. Then finally she went to the basement. I also went there. She screamed to see my mother there. She was dead. Flies and insects were there on her body. It was dreadful. She was in a chair. Her hands were bound with a rope and a tape on her mouth. I was so scared to see her in dirty clothes, messy hair, and injuries on her face. There was so much blood on the ground, which had come from her head. Then Janet called the cops. They reached after some time. One of them asked me about my father and Olive. I told them that they were in an amusement park. The cops reached there and arrested both of them. Then my father told the cops that when they were in Paris, my father made a plan to return after 3 days on the pretext of his business meeting because he wanted to be with Olive, and he fell in love with her. She was very beautiful. Olive also loved him. They used to spend time on the phone for hours. The night they reached home, the same night when my parents were sleeping in the room, my mother woke up in the middle of the night when she saw that my father was not there in the bed. When she came out of the room, she heard sounds from Olive's room. Then she pushed the door harder. My father was on the bed with Olive. My father rushed to my mother. Then Olive hit her with a statue, which was a decoration in that room. Then my father strangled her. Then she died and they both dragged her to the basement. Olive and my father were both charged for the murder of my mother and now have life in prison. I started to live with Janet. How unfortunate was everything for me. I lost my parents. I miss my mom so much.
My name is Mariana, and I was a school teacher. My husband works in a company. This is an incident when my son Rion was 5 years old. Due to the job, both of us, husband and wife, were unable to take full care of our son Rion. so we hired a babysitter for him. She was a 25-year-old girl, Mary, who had been taking care of Rion for the last 2 years. One day when I went to school, some of my fellow teachers were discussing something in the group. When I went to her, one of my companions was crying, and she told me that the babysitter who took care of her daughter injured her daughter in a very bad way. Then the school bell rang, class time started, and all the teachers went to their respective classes. I went home, and Mary was right there. Don't know why, I was suspecting her, but from the morning, I was worried about the bad babysitter incident. Then she came to me and smiled, and said, "Ma'am, I am leaving this job, because I'm going to get married in a few days. Find a new babysitter for Rion." I also did not say anything more than that, only I said, "Okay," and she left. Then I put up an online post that I need a babysitter for a baby boy. The next day I had to take leave from school to take care of Rion. Then in the morning I got a call from an unknown number. I picked up the call. She said, "My name is Nancy, and I am a babysitter. I have been doing this work for the last 6 years. I gave her my address and asked to come. She arrived after 2 hours. She was in a black wardrobe, quite simple, but attractive, and I didn't find anything suspicious in her. Rion was playing right there. When Nancy went to Rion, he started crying after seeing her. She said, 'Rion is crying seeing my new face. I will take care, you don't worry.' I was telling Nancy all that day about Rion's habits and all stuff about him. The next morning, my husband and I went to our job. Nancy, again in black dress, also came to take care of Rion on time. We were both happy and satisfied with Nancy. Then 2 days later, I noticed a change in Rion. He would sit continuously on a swing with bowed head in the garden outside. He stopped playing, and he didn't even make noise. I started worrying about Rion. When my husband came in the evening, I told him the whole thing. He said that perhaps the health of Rion is not good, so take him to the doctor. We consulted the doctor as well, but there was no problem in his health. The next morning when Nancy came, I said, 'Take good care of Rion and take special care of his food and drink. He has become sluggish.' She smiled and said, 'Okay, ma'am.' That day I asked my husband to drop me to school. We were both going in the car. I told him about my fellow teacher's babysitter incident and said, 'I doubt Nancy. She always wears a black wardrobe. Isn't it strange?' He said, 'Nancy is very simple and naive. She will not do anything wrong with our Rion. You don't be negative.' He dropped me at the school. When I reached home, Rion was sleeping. I said to Nancy, 'Why is Rion sleeping at the moment?' She said, 'Today he was tired of playing, so he fell asleep.' I said, 'Why do you wear black dresses daily?' She said with a very weird smile, 'I like this color.' 'Is there any problem in black color, ma'am?' I said, 'Nothing. You may go now.' She left and everything seemed doubtful to me, her way of smiling, gazing, and dressing style, etc. Then I went to check Rion. He had a blanket on his face, and as soon as I removed the blanket, I was shocked and scared. Rion's eyes were wide open and he was not even blinking his eyes. He ran screaming and sat on the swing outside in the garden. I was worried. I went to Rion and asked him to come inside. He was not answering me and kept his head bowed. When I put my hand on his shoulder, he bit very hard on my hand. So, Rion's father came from the office and seeing all this, he came to me. Then, Rion screamed and ran inside. I told my husband that something was going wrong. 'Nancy has done something with Rion.' He said, 'You're right. Now we have to do something.' That night, while Rion was sleeping, we put a camera in that room and connected it to the laptop. The next morning, Nancy came and both of us went in the car as usual. But going a little ahead of the house, we stopped the car and turned on the laptop and were looking at live recordings of Rion's room. My husband called the cops and told the whole thing, and in the short time the car of the cops also came to us there. One of the cops was sitting in the car with us watching the live camera recording. We were very nervous and scared after seeing all that. We saw Nancy go to Rian's room and say something in his ear, and he suddenly stood up in the air for 1 minute and then fell down on the bed. Nancy closed the window and set the curtains. She gestured with fingers to Rian, and he came to her walking in the air. Rian's feet were not touching the ground. Now, Rian lay on the ground. He was unconscious. Nancy raised both hands and started chanting something. Her shadow was falling on the wall, which suddenly became very large. It seemed like she was calling evil spirits. Her face also changed. Her skin became very rough and dirty. Her eyes became absolutely red. Actually, she was doing black magic. Yes, she was calling evil powers. The curtains of the room and all the stuff kept there started moving and falling. She then applied a cut to her wrist with a knife and spilled some drops of her blood on Rian. Rian was screaming. Then my husband and the cops ran into the house and went to that room. It was locked from inside. One of the cops pushed that door again and again. Then it broke. Nancy had a big knife in her hand. She attacked one. She was attacking everyone like a crazy person. Then one of the cops picked up a vase on the side and hit Nancy's head. She fainted and fell there. She was just injured. The cops had tied her with many tools and ropes. I took Rian in my lap and said sorry to him. He had become very weak. It was later discovered that Nancy used children to try new experiments in black magic. That is why she used to implicate children by becoming a fake babysitter. Later, she was admitted to a mental asylum for treatment. From that day itself, I had left my teacher job, and then I started taking care of Rian.
I recently took a job in a tea garden. I am a 28-year-old male. I had to shift to this small hill station to work as a tea estate manager. My mom was worried, as I'll be living completely alone. That too in a faraway hill station, but I always enjoyed being alone. I had a girlfriend, but we broke up a few years back. Since then, I preferred being single until I really met someone interesting. So, back to the story. One Sunday morning, I reached the tea garden. Another employee named Mr. Duff showed me the entire area and took me to the bungalow where I will be staying. The bungalow was on top of a hill. There was nothing around the house except for huge mountains and steep valleys. The view from my bedroom window was breathtaking. I used to roam around the tea estate and look after the production and works there. The daytimes were busy enough, but the nights were filled with silence. Except for the blowing of the winds and chirping of crickets, there was not a single sound after the sun was set. The first week went without any trouble, and I started enjoying my life in solitude, but suddenly things took a different turn. One night, I woke up hearing someone humming in a low voice. I tried to hear carefully. It was a woman's voice. A woman was humming a weird tune somewhere near the bungalow. The sound was coming from outside, so there's nothing much I could do about it. I thought it might be some village girl, but it felt odd that she's awake and roaming in the hills during midnight. I ignored it and went back to sleep. The next day, I finished my work early and decided to head back to finish some important paperwork. I started walking towards the exit gate of the garden. Mr. Duff accompanied me on the way. As we walked between the tea garden, I asked, "Is there any village nearby the bungalow, Mr. Duff?" He looked at me with a confused face and said, "Nope. No one lives near the bungalow." "But why'd you ask?" I said, "Nothing. It's just last night a girl was singing in the valley. I could hear her from the bedroom. Not actually singing, rather humming a very mysterious tune." Mr. Duff suddenly became a bit awkward and said, "Well, you must have heard the night owl or some other animal howling. In hills, sounds echo a lot." "I'm sure it was nothing." He didn't speak the entire way, and I returned home with a curious feeling in my heart. That night, after dinner, I decided if I hear the humming tune tonight, I will come out of the house and see for myself. I did, as planned. Around 2 a.m., the humming tune in the same female voice took place. I tiptoed to the bedroom balcony. The chilly wind and fog were all over the valley. As far as my eyes went, I could only see huge mountains and pale moonlight flooding all over the valley. Suddenly, something caught my eye. As I turned towards the gate of the bungalow, I saw a village girl standing near it. She was looking directly at me, smiling. There was something in her smile that made my senses numb. I don't know how long I stood there staring at her. She hummed the tune again and started to call me, gesturing her hand. I asked in a loud voice, "Hello, do you need any help? Are you all right?" She didn't say anything, just stood there and smiled. I could tell she was extremely beautiful, but something about her appearance made her appear like a mystery. Her long hair was floating in the wind. She again called me, and this time I couldn't resist anymore. I came out of the house, opened the gate. The girl was now standing at about 10 to 15 hands distance from me. I was feeling very cold, but something kept telling me in my ears that I needed to follow her. The girl chuckled, and her laugh echoed in the entire valley. She then said, "I am lost. I'm trying to find my way in the dark. Can you help me?" There was no way I could say no to her, so I just nodded my head. She again said in her crystal clear voice, "My house is down the valley, and I'm scared to go alone. Would you accompany me there?" I don't know what happened before I could say yes. My legs just started to walk with her own. The girl was walking in front of me while humming her magical tune, and I was following her like a child with an empty mind. The way she walked, it felt like she was almost floating in the air. Her feet didn't touch the ground for once. We were going on like this when she stopped humming, and suddenly my eyes went ahead. My blood rushed to my face as I discovered she was walking towards the steep edge of the valley. Not just that, she was pulling me with her supernatural power all this way. I realized if I kept following her like this, my body will fall from this 1,000-foot-deep valley, and no one will ever find a single trace of me. I said in a panicked voice,
Where you take me?"
She suddenly stopped and turned backward. Her pretty face was now the face of a demon. Her eyes were coming out, and the skin on her face was rotten, and bones were visible underneath. She started to laugh in her demonic voice, and she grasped my hand. I started to scream and free myself from her grasp, but she just kept pulling me and pulling me towards the edge. I realized my end was near, and we were almost at the edge when someone pulled my collar from the other side. As I started to faint out of shock, I saw with my fading eyes it was Mr. Duff. A day later, I regained my consciousness. Mr. Duff was sitting near my bed and a doctor was checking my pulse. Mr. Duff told me, "This place is cursed, sir. A long time back, a village girl committed suicide from the mountain edge near the bungalow. Since then, her spirit haunts this place and tries to lure men down the valley. I thought you might fall in her trap, so I came to your bungalow last night. I'm sorry. I should have told you sooner." I didn't say a single word to him. Just waited to get better and then left the job immediately. I am never going back to the Haunted Reaper ever again, but her fairy-like tune still echoes in my ears at night.
I used to study in a college. Our financial condition was not good. That is why I used to study during the day and in the evening used to work part-time at a pizza shop. My job shift was from 6 p.m. to 12 p.m. in the evening. One night, a pizza order arrived at 11:10 p.m. "There is an apartment 20 to 25 minutes away from here. Deliver pizza there and go straight home."
"But boss, that area is the exact opposite of my house. It's now 11:15 p.m. I won't have time to make pizza and deliver it until 12 o'clock, and it will be about 1 o'clock when I get back home."
"Look, this is your job. You have to do it. I'll pay you extra for this." After 15 minutes, I took the pizza and got on my bike for delivery. I received a pizza delivery order to an apartment. I reached the apartment at 11:55 at night. I had to deliver the pizza to room number 301.
I went to the lift. Room number 301 was locked. I took out the mobile from my pocket to call the customer. What's this? The mobile's been switched off. Then I got confused a bit. I thought, maybe the room number is not 301, that the room number will be 310. I made a mistake about the digit. Now I started to move towards room number 310. The room was on the next floor. I started going up from the stairs. It was quite dark there. The gallery there was also quite dark. I was feeling a little scared. I stood outside room number 310 and knocked on the door. Hello? Is anyone inside? Did you order a pizza? There was no response from any of the room. When I knocked on the door a little harder, it opened. I went inside. Everything was scattered there. So many spider webs were there. I tried to turn on the light, but it did not. I was feeling very scared. I went inside a little bit and the curtains were flying due to the very strong wind there. While looking at the room, I looked towards a window and there was a very terrible looking woman standing at the window. I said in a trembling voice, "Ma'am, what are you doing here at the window? Did you order a pizza?" Her mouth was tilted down. She did not answer and I walked in a little further. "Hello, ma'am? Do you need any help? Ma'am?" I took a step forward. The woman turned her face up and she jumped down the window screaming out loud. It was very scary. She had deep wounds on her face and blood was coming. I was scared too much. When I looked down from the window, there was no one there. I got drenched with sweat and very quickly left the pizza and got out of there. I ran towards the lift, but the lift of that floor was not working. I ran to the ninth floor and saw that there was a lift going down. I quickly went into it and came out of the apartment and ran away on my bike. I was riding a bike at a very high speed. The roads were deserted. After some time, I turned my face slightly to the side. Then the same terrible woman was running at full speed with my bike. I was scared and shocked. She was not a living lady. She was a ghost. My senses were blown away. I could see my death. A short distance away, I saw a church. I stopped my bike and went inside the church. Shortly thereafter, I fell asleep. And in the morning, the father of the church woke me up.
"What happened, son? Have a nightmare?"
"Yes, father. It was the same as a nightmare." I went home and quit that job. I had the habit of sleeping late as my exams were around the corner. Never before had I ever felt this weird sense of discomfort that I was feeling that night. I lived in the western suburbs of the city, and thus my house was remotely situated. It was not often that I was scared of sleeping alone, but that day was just different. There were so many things on my mind about my work that I forgot to look at the window of my room. A cold breeze blew inside the room and made me aware of the fact that the window was open. I looked outside the window and stared into complete darkness. Usually there was a lamp at the corner of the street that burnt bright and allowed me to look outside my window clearly, but that day, there was simply no visibility. As my phone pinged and I went ahead to reach my phone, I sensed something moving outside the window. I looked again, but everything was still outside. Disregarding this, I checked my messages and rolled my eyes. It was the Corona alert once again. This was the fifth time I was receiving the message to be aware of the Corona in your house. How would Corona even enter my house? I was working from home. As I pondered upon the message, something crashed loudly outside in the alley. I rushed to see if there was some cat in the trash cans making the havoc, but the alley was completely empty. I came back inside to find this weird silhouette of a man standing in my living room. The body of the man looked completely normal, but he was wearing something circular on his head. I was afraid to approach the person, but I also thought that it might be one of my friends pulling a prank on me. I decided to muster the courage and confront the stranger in my house. "Who are you?" I asked as my voice shook a little. "What are you doing in my house?" The man came closer a few steps, and a recording started playing in the voice of Cardi B.
"Coronavirus! Coronavirus!"
If this was a prank, it was not funny at all. My legs shivered a little as the man started approaching me with a knife in his hand.
I grabbed the phone and ran into my room, locking the doors from the inside. I tried calling the cops, but there was no signal on my phone. In panic, I tried to make sense of the message I had received earlier. Did the authorities know that a vandal was roaming the streets pretending to be coronavirus? Is this what they meant when they asked me not to let the disease enter the house? These thoughts rushed through my brain as the door of my room banged loudly. The phone slipped through my hands and on the floor as the banging stopped. I suddenly realized that the window to my room was still open. I ran to close the window, but it was too late. The man was already inside and was now approaching me threateningly. I searched for a weapon to use against the assailant, but my brain froze for a few minutes. My last resort was running towards the bathroom, but before I could do so, a strong arm grabbed me and was pulling me towards it. I kicked and pushed, but the man was too strong. He was trying to say something, but I could not make sense of it in the chaos. After a long struggle, I was too tired to fight anymore. I gave up and listened to what the man had to say. "Sally, it's me, Parker," he said in a robotic voice. "I am stuck in my Halloween costume. Can you please use this knife to rip it off?" The next time my eyes opened, I was lying in a hospital with Parker standing beside my bed. "What happened?" he asked anxiously.
"You scared the hell out of me," I said irritably. "You are the worst brother ever."
"I realize I shouldn't have played that prank on you, but I was genuinely stuck."
"Just never do it again, okay?"
"Sure." My name is Hannah. I used to live with my parents. It was a matter of those days when I was studying in college. Then the college holidays were going on, and I used to work part-time at a pizza shop. I used to be on the job from 4 to 10 p.m. in the evening. Once on a Sunday, I was playing a game on my mobile. Then in it, again and again, an ad named OnlyFans was visible, which was related to earning money. I also wanted to earn money, so I was attracted to seeing that ad again and again. I clicked on it. It had hot pics and videos of many girls, and their fans had comments. The sign-in option was also visible there, so I created my profile on it. It used to earn on adding new fans, and more fans were also added on uploading photos. I also clicked some of my hot pics, took some selfies, and uploaded them. Text messages started coming to me, like beautiful, hot, sexy, cute, etc. I was very happy. The next day, I shared my live video while going for duty at the pizza shop. While working at the pizza shop, I uploaded a few of my pics in several poses. A friend of mine named Chelsea, who works with me, interrupted me and said, "What are you doing? Have you gone mad? Just been busy taking photos on the phone since morning. What is going on?" And I just ignored her with looks. On reaching home that night, I was making a few hot poses in a bikini in my room, clicking pics with a selfie stick. Then suddenly my mother came to my room. She shouted at me, "Shameless girl, what the hell are you doing?" I quickly dressed, and then my father also came. My mother told the whole thing to my father. My father scolded me and said, "You do all this by going somewhere else." I got very angry. At the same time, I called my friend Chelsea and said, "I'm coming to you." She lived in a separate rental house from her parents. I went to stay at her house. My same routine continued for 2 days. Using the phone during the day, clicking pics, going to the job in the evening, and coming back and passing time on the phone again. The next day, after returning home at 10 p.m., before entering home, I clicked my selfie outside the house. In my room, I was using OnlyFans app and got a message from a boy named Nikolai. "Hi, beautiful."
"Hey."
"You are really beautiful."
"Thank you."
"You work at a pizza shop."
"Yeah. You have seen my pics at the pizza shop."
"No, I saw you."
"When?"
"Daily."
"Do you work somewhere near that pizza shop?"
"No. I have my own business." "Leave this topic. Send me some hot pics of yours."
"Excuse me. First tell me about you."
"I said send some pics and send $20.
He sent me his account number. "Are you kidding me? Why should I send money? You should send me money."
He sent me a pic of mine sitting in that pizza shop.
It was 2 days old and not clicked by me. How is this? How dare you? Who are you, and why did you click my pic? He sent me my pic of yesterday at my friend's house. I was sitting in the garden outside the house. This is so beautiful.
What do you want?
Just you and money. He sent me a pic with my friend Chelsea of today at noon, sitting in the living area. Your friend is also beautiful, but you are more.
I panicked. I called Chelsea to come to me. She was not at home at the time. She was at a party and not responding to my call. He sent me a pic of mine lying on the bed and using the phone. It was a 5-minute-old pic.
I was sweating and panicked. I just turned and looked at the window. It was open. That pic was taken from there. The person was at the window 5 minutes ago. When I went to close the window, suddenly a strange-looking man came to the window. I screamed loudly and left the room and hid in a kitchen cupboard. I put my hands over my mouth so that there was no noise. He was speaking after saying my name.
Hannah, come to me. Where did you hide?
He was coming out of the room. I was unable to speak, so I couldn't call the police. Then I sent a text message to my father and mother's phone that a stranger has entered forcefully here, and I hid in the kitchen cupboard. Help me, please. Then I also called my parents again and again so that they would see my message. After 2 minutes, my father replied,
Don't you worry. We're coming, and I've called the cops. Stay there.
By now, that unknown man was roaming all over the house and was calling my name. After some time, the siren of the police van was heard. The cops came to the house, and my parents also came. They were looking for that man everywhere, but he could not be found. One of them started questioning me about how the man looked. Did I ever see him? Was he a friend of mine? I had never seen that person before. That man seemed to be a psycho. I told how the whole thing had started after creating a profile on an app named OnlyFans. That man followed me everywhere and secretly clicked my photos, but I had never seen him in front of me. After he left, I apologized to my parents and went back to my home. While I was sleeping, I was thinking about all this. Then I remembered when I clicked my pic outside Chelsea's house, which also had a pic of the board behind me, from which he must have taken my address, and from the pics of the pizza shop, he found that I worked at that shop. I just deleted all my pics from OnlyFans, and also deleted my account. I changed my job, and after that, I never saw that man again.
I still remember the day so vividly when I ended up in my friend Josie's basement with a bunch of our friends playing Truth or Dare. I'm Mindy, 18, and recently graduated high school. It was our graduation party, and we all were drunk or stoned, so instead of dancing the night off, we all decided to make it a bit more crazy by playing Truth or Dare before everyone goes off to college. When it was my turn, I chose Dare, just for the thrill of it. We all were adults, so dares were daring. One of my friends suggested that I open an OnlyFans account, run it for 6 months, and then throw a great party with the earned money when we all return to town for our first semester break. Trust me, at that time it sounded like a pretty good idea to earn more money. And who doesn't like parties? We were teens, pretty open to everything. So the next day I signed up for an OnlyFans account and started posting content. At first it was pretty innocent photos of me, sitting in a park, driving, etc. I also did some live streaming while I packed for college. But once I was settled in my college dorm, I decided to post some explicit content. I had a roommate named Rhea. She was pretty nerdy and had no social life and interests besides studying all day. So most of the time she was in the library studying or busy with her part-time job at a local bookstore, which left the whole dorm to me. Each day after lectures, I used to do myself up and click cute and sexy pictures of myself. My fan following was increasing day by day, and more people were getting my paid subscription. I was pretty famous on the site, and was making a good part-time income without doing any part-time job at all. My live streams were more often, and I interacted with my fans as frequently as I could. My roommate had her own idea about my OnlyFans account, and tried to talk me out of it a lot of times. But my increasing bank balance helped me erase all her lectures from my mind pretty easily. She was a bore anyway. In one of my fan interactions, I was answering some usual fan questions when a direct message popped up on my screen. Being a regular user, I read the message and was happy to see one more fan reaching out to me with praise and support. So I decided to interact with this fan. It turned out to be a lady named Sia, in her late 30s, looking for advice and guidance on how to start an OnlyFans account, and had been my follower for a few months. I gave her a few tips, thinking it to be a casual interaction, but then I was naive and did not know the world so well. I did not think twice about why a married woman with two kids wanted to start an OnlyFans account. She had shared a lot of information about her personal life with me. Quickly, we became friends. She gave me some career and life advice, while I taught her to pose in posts and edit them with the latest filters. We did share a lot of personal information, so she knows where I lived, studied, my family, friends, etc., and vice versa. I even told her how I started an OnlyFans account as a dare. I thought I had found a friend through this site. My account was thriving. I was making twice as much as Rhea made in her part-time job at the bookstore. My content on OnlyFans was becoming more adult and revealing as the time passed. It just added more followers and paid subscribers, which in turn brought more money. It had been 4 months since I started my account, and one day, one more direct message popped on my account while I was active. It was from a man called Dave. He said, "Hey, Mindy. You're gorgeous. I've been your follower from day one and wanted to interact with you for a long time, but I was kind of shy." I thought it was a cute text, so I quickly replied in a flirty tone saying, "Hey, Dave, now that you're interacting with me, why don't you tell me how gorgeous I am?" He replied within seconds with praises and encouragement for my career. I was happy to hear from him. Suddenly, his questions started getting a bit personal. So I kept replying with minimum words and finally deciding to log out of my account as I quickly became tired of answering his nonstop questions. While I was pressing the logout button, the last message popped up from Dave asking me to go out with him. Mostly, all of my fans were local or from towns nearby, so I knew Dave lived nearby, maybe in a neighboring town. That night, I also got several messages from Sia asking to help her shop for something more revealing online. So I and Sia ended up choosing outfits for her online. After that day, Dave never messaged me. Sia and I had also planned to meet up at her house a couple of days later. I was about to visit her on the weekend for lunch with her family. When I reached her house, it was exactly as it was from the pictures she sent me. I knocked on the door, and a smiling Sia opened the door. I entered the house, finally happy to see my online friend in person. But one thing was off. Her family was missing. When I asked, she told me her kids were at a friend's birthday party and her husband had last-minute work at the office, so it was just us. We had lunch and chatted a lot. Once lunch was done, she offered me a house tour. As I was going through her study, a single photo stole my breath away. I quickly recognized the person from his profile photo online. It was Dave. But the surprising thing was, it was Sia in his wedding photo. I turned around only to see Sia standing with a knife in her hand looking at me with disgust. I quickly pieced two and two together, but before I could say a word, Sia said, "You ruined it, my marriage. He loved you, not me, followed your account daily. When I tried to dress up like you, be like you, he hated me. He only ever loved you, so I had to do it." I was confused by what she meant by "it." She continued holding the knife pointed at me. "I killed the man I loved, my husband, because for him I wasn't enough, and now you need to die too, to pay for it." She screamed and rushed at me, but fortunately I was quicker. I rushed out of the study window into the lawn, unlocked my car, and drove away. I reported this incident and got Sia arrested for an attempted murder. I deleted the account and focused on my college. And suggest no one join OnlyFans ever.
My name is Noah. I am a school teacher. My school is situated in an isolated area out of the city. This incident happened last year. I used to teach in 10th class in school. The normal life of routine was going on. One day, an advertisement of the vacancy of chemistry teacher was published in the newspaper for our school. Then, on the same day, a man came for the interview for the job of school teacher. His name was Jacob. He went to the principal's office. I was there, too. It was his first day at school. He wore formal clothes. He was wearing glasses, looking very simple. He carried a big black bag on his shoulders. The principal asked him some questions. He was very smart and answered every question appropriately. He was appointed as a chemistry teacher. The next day, he started working as a teacher. He had become friendly with me. He used to say hello to me as soon as he came to school. We both got along. After 2 days, we were having lunch in the staff room. His phone was kept there on the table. His phone rang. The number of an outer country was being shown on the screen. He quickly covered the screen with his hand and got up from there and went a short distance away and started talking on the phone, standing near the window. His facial expressions had changed. He looked so fake, but I didn't understand anything at that time. After 5 minutes, he came back and sat down. I asked, "Who called you? You seem upset." Jacob replied, "My wife had a call. She belongs to another country, and now she wants to divorce me." I said, "I'm sorry." I thought I was unnecessarily doubting him. The man was already upset. One day, he took the students of his class to the chemistry lab. The recess period had started. All the children were in the cafeteria and in the garden. All the teachers were also in the staff room, but Jacob was not there. I went to the chemistry lab. There was a small storeroom inside the chemistry lab, in which the stock of chemicals and equipment was kept. It was normally closed. It was opened only when needed. When I went there, Jacob was closing that storeroom. I asked, "Jacob, why don't you come for lunch?" He just about to come. Some chemicals were reduced in the lab here. That's why I was taking chemicals from the storeroom. He came to me, saying, "Let's go for lunch." When I went back to class after lunch, there was a lot of noise among the children. I told them to shut up and asked what happened. A student said, "Sir, I can't find my friend Shane." I was shocked. I asked, "What do you mean? Did he come to school today?" The student said, "Yes, he was here before recess. I was having lunch and playing during recess, so I didn't pay attention, but he was not with me even at that time." During this, a lot of noise started coming from other areas of the school as well. I ran there, and some teachers were also present there, but Jacob was not. Then it was found that 4 students were missing from there too. There was noise in the whole school. I went to the principal's office. There, I started talking about it. Only then the voices started coming from the main door of the school. The main door of the school was very large, and it was kept closed during school time, so that students could not go out during school time. 2 men were coming in from over the door with guns in their hands. They wore black clothes, and their faces were covered with masks. The guard sitting there was also killed. We got scared. The principal announced over the speakers that terrorists have entered the school and the school should be locked down immediately. All teachers, go to the classroom with your students and lock the room. There were speakers everywhere in the school, due to which this information reached everyone. I ran towards my classroom with the principal. All the students and teachers were running here and there, locking themselves in their classrooms. I quickly took my students to class and locked the door from inside. There was glass on the door. I saw that 4 students were still out. He was knocking on the classroom, but no one was opening the door. I heard gunshots. I told the principal, "You take care of these children. Quickly call the cops. I will go out and save their lives." I opened the door and went out. I went to those 4 students. Just then, a terrorist came there. There was the chemistry lab nearby. I went with those students to the same lab and locked the door. I put tables and chairs in front of the door. I pulled out my phone to call the cops. but the signal was not reaching my phone. Perhaps the terrorists had put jammers in the school so that no one could call the cops. That is why there was no signal on my phone. Then a terrorist came to our door and started banging. He was trying hard to break the glass of the door. There were many chemicals in the lab. A chemical was kept there on which it was written, "Do not touch directly. It is harmful." When I dropped it lightly on the ground, a lot of hot smoke came out of it. But that was very little. When I quickly opened the lab storeroom, I was shocked to see the 5 students who were missing were there in the storeroom. Their hands were tied, and there were bandages on their mouths, too. I asked other students to free them, and I was looking for the same chemical. I found a lot. I took 10 empty bottles and put chemicals in all of them and gave each bottle to all the students. The door was in the middle of the classroom. On both sides, the students and I just stood with bottles of chemicals. The terrorist was still banging on the door. Then the glass broke, and the tables and chairs lying in front of the door also started falling. As soon as he opened the door, we dropped that harmful chemical on him, and it was burning, and he started shouting loudly. I hit the chair on his head, and he fainted. I took off his mask. It was Jacob. Then I picked up his gun. I asked those students to hide in the storeroom. I put on Jacob's mask and clothes. I also looked terrorist now and sneaked out into the corridor. There was no one there. I went further. Then another terrorist came there. He said to me, "Jacob, come to the chemistry lab. We have to take those 5 kids from here. Hurry up." He was running towards the chemistry lab. I was after him. As soon as he reached there, he saw Jacob lying unconscious. I shot him in the leg. He fell there and started screaming. I then hit the chair on his head as well. He fainted. I went to the principal's office and from there announced that, "It's nowhere here. You all come out of the classrooms. Both the terrorists are in an unconscious state." Then all teachers and students came out. There was a jammer on the wall at one place, due to which our phones were not working. I broke that jammer and then called the cops. In a while, the cops came and arrested both of them. Investigation revealed that Jacob was a terrorist, and he also wanted to take those 5 children to make them terrorists. By the grace of God, everyone survived that day, but the gatekeeper had lost his life. It was a very dangerous and scary incident. My name is James. I'm studying in the first year of graduation. I've had a few unforgettable experiences in my past. This story was during my 10th standard. I had seen a school going into lockdown for the first time. I used to be a naughty kid in school. I always used to prank my fellow students and sometimes even the teachers. Everyone was fed up with my actions. I used to go to the principal's office daily as everyone used to complain about me. The principal gave me a warning most of the time, and he even called my parents and said that if I didn't change my behavior, they'd expel me from school. I cared little and continued with my pranks. One day I pranked one of my classmates. It was then that things got worse for me. He was one of the most studious students, and he was the teacher's favorite. I pranked him using a ghost mask, and he was so afraid that he fainted and was admitted into the hospital. This led me to the principal's office, and he scolded me and immediately called my parents. When they came, he told them about this incident and said that I was expelled from the school. Then my parents took me home. My parents were very furious at what I had done and scolded me. They said that I should not have done this. Then they decided to send me to a boarding school. I was shocked at their decision and told them that I'll not go to any boarding school, but eventually I had to go to a boarding school. This school had very strict rules, and those who didn't follow them were punished. This school had a history of changing very naughty students into decent ones. I was not at all happy, but no one bothered about me. I was very sad, but my parents didn't listen to me, and they left me there alone. I burst into tears when they left. I was crying loudly. I was taken to my room, and the warden asked me to get ready fast, as I have to attend classes. Then he went away. I was alone in the room and was crying out loud. I got ready, but I was still crying. Suddenly, I heard weird noises. It was like someone calling my name, but in a slow, ghostly sound. Then my heart skipped a beat. I suddenly stopped crying and ran away towards the classroom. I went inside the class and introduced myself to the teacher and the class. Then the rest of the class also introduced themselves. I was not paying attention, as I was still thinking about those noises. Then the class finished, and we went to our room. It was time to eat, and everyone was going for dinner. But I told them that I'm not feeling hungry, and asked them to go. Then I was alone in the room, and was thinking about my parents, and weeping. Suddenly, I heard the same noises again. I was terrified, and tried to run, but I fell. Then I felt someone was coming towards me. At this moment, I went numb and couldn't do anything. Then I fainted and I fell there. When I woke up, I saw that I was lying on the bed and the boys and the warden surrounded me. They asked what happened to me, but I wasn't able to tell them anything. I was very afraid. Then the warden asked everyone to sleep and he left. The next morning, my parents called me and I was talking to them. They asked me how the school was and all. I said everything was fine, in a low tone. They asked me the reason for my strange behavior and asked if something was wrong. I told them everything that had happened, about the voice I was hearing, and said that I'm very much afraid. I asked them to take me away, but they thought it was one of my pranks, trying to get out of the school. I told them that I was telling the truth, but they didn't listen and cut the call. I was sad after this and went to my class after hanging up on the phone. In class, I was sitting and the class was going on, and suddenly we heard an announcement. The school is going into lockdown. It was the principal, and he said that a psychopath had attacked our school, and for the safety of the students, the school is going into lockdown. He also said that the police have been informed, and they'll be here as soon as possible. Hearing this, the teacher immediately ran to the door and closed it. He also closed the windows. He asked the students to hide under the tables. We did the same. Suddenly, the lights started going on and off. Thunders started rumbling, and the weather changed completely. Then I heard the voice that had been haunting me, and went to the teacher and asked if he heard the voice. The teacher said that he didn't hear anything, and asked me to go and hide under the table. But the voice was loud and could be heard clearly. Then I thought of finding out the truth about this voice. I opened the door and banged it hard. The door got jammed, but still, I ran to find out who it was. When I came out, I found out that the voice was coming from the classroom towards the end of the corridor. I ran towards it down the corridor, but then a very strange thing happened. When I was running down the corridor, it felt like I was stuck in one place, but I was running. Then I saw a right and turned there, but to my surprise, here also the corridor looked the same. This happened for some time, and I was exhausted. Then I heard the voice and found out that it was coming from behind. I turned suddenly, but could not find anyone. Now I was afraid of what was happening. I decided to run away from there. I kept running for some time, but eventually I reached the same place again and again. I didn't know what was happening. Then, suddenly, I stopped as I felt someone was coming towards me from behind. I was terrified and turned around to see who it was. Then I finally saw that a man was standing there holding a knife pointed towards me. I was in shock seeing a man like that. Then he started coming towards me. Then I tried to run away from there. As I tried to run, my leg slipped and I fell to the floor. Then I tried to get up and run, but the man came and sat on my chest. His eyes were blood red. I was under him, and he was about to stab me with a knife. But in the meantime, the police arrived and shot him in his hand. Then the knife fell aside. Then the police officer came towards us immediately and caught the psycho. My life was saved. The police said the psycho ran away from the mental asylum and was attacking everyone with a knife. Then they took him away. I thought that now everything would return to normal, but even after the psycho was caught I could still hear the weird sounds. After this, I fainted and fell on the floor. Then, when I woke up, the warden was sitting there, and he asked me what had happened to me. But I couldn't utter a word, and was still afraid of what had happened. Seeing me like this, the warden called my parents. Next time when I woke up, I found that my parents were there. They got worried seeing me like that. I asked them to take me away from there and kept crying. Seeing me like that, they even decided that I shouldn't be there and they took me away. This incident still haunts me. I still think about whose voice that was and why only I could hear it. But eventually, I let it go out of my mind. But memories of the past days stay always with us, especially the bad ones.
Well, y'all, that is my time. I hope that y'all enjoyed the show as well as I did. I know I started tonight's show. That's because, you know, I had to go support my bro on his show. He had an open mic night, so me being the poet that I am, you know, I had to show up and show out, as only I can. But anyway, show up tomorrow, same time, same place. Let me stop saying same time, same place. I will be live tomorrow. But just like I always say, if you're following me here on Blog Talk, then you would know what time the show gonna start. So that's your fault. You're not following. Anyway, I'm gonna leave y'all with the thought of the night. And the thought of the night is this: you can't pick and choose when to be loyal. Because only time that you can truly be loyal is if you're reciprocating the time and the energy that is being poured into you. If you're only half-assed the loyalty, you can't be surprised that it's being half-assed to you. So, with that being said, love, peace, and blessings. Pray before you like. I love y'all. Good night.